Hi, and welcome to today's meeting of Book Hoarders Anonymous. Let's all begin by introducing ourselves.
Hi, I'm Shannon, and I'm a book hoarder.
Hi, Shannon.
Hi, I'm Erin, and I'm a book hoarder.
Hi, Erin.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the October 2014 edition of Book Hoarders Anonymous. I'm Erin.
And I'm Shannon.
And we're here to talk about all things book.
And we should have come up with like spooky nicknames for ourselves.
I know.
Because it's Halloween, but we didn't.
We didn't. And for instance, Shannon on Twitter is displaying herself as Shannon Crypt instead of her more traditional Shannon C. We do have a friend who's displaying herself as Zombie Diana, which I think is funny.
Yes.
And I am displaying myself as Erin Edgar, which is totally boring. But that's just me.
You could be Erin Edgar Allan Poe.
There you go. Erin Edgar Allan Poe. Maybe I'll change my screen name for, you know, on Halloween to that for just that day.
Yeah.
That would be funny. Okay. So, yeah. We are here to talk about what we've been reading this month. And our book, which was very horrifying. At least I thought it was very creepy. Nosferatu by Joe Hill. I guess they want you to pronounce it like the German word for vampire. I started reading the book, I realized that that was what it was all about. I was pronouncing it like the license plate. I mean, because it is a license plate, but it's a vanity plate. So,
yes.
But we'll get to that later. Meanwhile, what have you been reading this month?
I've been reading a lot of interesting things. And so I'll start with the ones that I didn't have a discussion topic about that I wanted to digress into.
There we go. Okay.
Since it is October, I've been reading a lot of horror, and the best thing I read this month was a book by Michael McDowell.
Mm-hmm.
It is a 6-part serial novel, really. They don't really package it that way on Bard, but it is. It's called Blackwater, and it's set in a small southern Alabama town, and in 1919, this woman arrives, and she's rescued from a hotel that's been, the town is flooded, and she's in the flooded-out hotel, and she gets rescued by this prominent family, and then the novel basically goes into the lives of this family for the next 50 years or so, and how this woman, Eleanor, has kind of come in and how she changes things. And it's a different kind of horror than, like, say, Nosferatu, because it's not, it's more sort of, like, subtle. It's about people, and a lot of the horror is just, like, what people are capable of doing to each other. And there are supernatural elements, but they're not flashy, I guess I'd say. And I really liked it. And the Bard narrator, with a much younger J. Michael McCullough, did an excellent job. And it's a great, like, you could read it for about, each section is about 5 hours long. So they're really easy to kind of knock back. Mm-hmm. In an afternoon.
I actually read that whole thing in one sitting. I sped up my player and I just read it all in one day. It was, you know, like 15 hours of this day was devoted to reading this saga, for lack of a better word. I thought it was so wonderful. I just couldn't put it down.
Was so great.
And you're right that the supernatural elements, except for when you get into maybe the last book, kind of like not really. You could choose whether or not to interpret them as supernatural elements, you know, whether you wanted to or not. The floods and, you know, the levee breaking and all this kind of thing. Well, was it really supernatural or did it just happen? But by the last book, it's kind of, you kind of figure out, I guess, for lack of a better word, that there really is some kind of supernatural force involved. In all of these different occurrences. So I really enjoyed that as well. And
Did you read it because I told you about it?
No, I read it last year.
Oh, you read it last year, okay.
And it was something that I put on my Bard wish list and just said, ooh, I want to read this. And then one day I just decided, I have nothing to do today. I'm going to read it. And I did, and it was wonderful.
It was, and you know, definitely recommend it for horror that's a little bit different. Let's see. I'm reading, oh, and right now I kind of have decided to keep going in that vein, and one of the books I'm currently reading is Robert McCammon's Swan Song, which is, I was a little skeptical of it at first because it looked a little bit like a cross between Stephen King's The Stand, which I loved, and Justin Cronin's The Passage, which I never have been able to finish.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of is, but and it's really long. Like, that's what it has in common with both of them. And I'm about 4 hours into it, and it's really, really good so far, but also there's only really one character that I'm attached to at this point, and so it makes it a little, I've been able to put it down.
Mm-hmm. Is this the one where there's like a nuclear war and then people need to survive afterwards?
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't started that yet, although I've thought about it. I just don't have time to read anything overly long at the moment, so I'm afraid that it's going to be something that I won't want to put down, but that I'll have to because of life and other commitments. So I've got that on my back burner at the moment.
And then the last one I'll mention before we get into like the thing I wanted to actually have a conversation about was that I started reading an urban fantasy series, and I just finished it on Friday. And the first book is called Kindling the Moon. The author is Jen Bennett, and they're on Bookshare. I can't find audio versions, which makes me kind of sad because I think they'd be really good audio. And she's got another series that has been put into, well, at least it's on Bard. But it's about Arcadia Bell, who is a bartender who's been kind of like on the run from this magical order because her parents were implicated in these gruesome crimes. And so she's been in hiding and you know, trying to prove her parents' innocence. And it's a lot of, I mean, there's a lot, I don't really read a lot of urban fantasy because I feel like there are a lot of sort of stereotypical things that happen in a lot of them. Like there's going to be some kick-ass woman and she doesn't need anybody, but then it turns out she does. And there's like one, sometimes even two or three love interests. And, you know, like you read one, you read them all. It sort of seems to me, but I really liked this one because she like, I got her reasons for being, you know, I don't need anybody kind of thing. And she was a bartender. So it wasn't like she was just being like, you know, a loner by choice. Like she was still always seeing people. She just wasn't particularly honest about who she was.
Mm-hmm.
And also the love interest was very different. He was, at least from my experience, he turns out to be kind of a scholar and a dabbler in magic. And there are these this most of what the supernatural that we encounter in this first book are demons. And so he's like a demon that's been caught in this body that's stuck on Earth. And he's a single father and he has a 13-year-old son. And
a demon like, with a son. That's interesting.
Yeah. And that like and there's obviously some more stuff about their pasts that, you know, will go in for future installments. But I really liked the three of them, Arcadia and then the guy and his son, how they're kind of like forming this family.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very cute without being necessarily schmaltzy.
Oh, that's good.
So yeah, Kindling the Moon is the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully I will get to the next few in sometime very soon. I'm trying. And then the last thing I wanted to bring up, which was something that like has been kind of on my mind, is I read Anne Jameson's nonfiction book, Fic, Why Fanfiction is Taking Over the World. Again, this is on Bookshare. And she talks about the history of fanfiction. And I've been a dabbler in fanfiction. I've read a lot of it. I've written a couple of short pieces, but nothing, you know, too like out there. Mm-hmm. But I find it really fascinating. And she delves into a lot of early fan fiction history, like talking about how Sherlock Holmes was basically the first fandom as we know it, because there were even people like J.M. Barrie, the author mm-hmm. of Peter Pan, who wrote Sherlock Holmes pastiche. And, you know, was even very, like, he was a contemporary of Arthur Conan Doyle's. And when Conan Doyle stopped writing Sherlock stories, he, like, was one of the ones that was like, hey!
Don't stop!
Don't stop them! So, and then now we have, like, and Sherlock Holmes has had so many iterations over the years. Like, everything from, like, all the, you know, the original short stories to all the movies, mm-hmm. including the recent one with Robert Downey Jr. And then there's, like, the Elementary on CBS and Sherlock from the BBC with Benedict Cumberbatch. And it's just, like there's so much, like, that people have taken away from all of these, like, these short stories. And it's just, it was just really interesting. And then they talked a little bit about Star Wars and Star Trek and Harry Potter but there's a lot of the book was, focused on Twilight, which is a book I've never finished because, I tried.
Yeah. I only got through the first one, so don't feel too bad.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I've told this story on the podcast before, but I remember that my sister was like, here, I'm going to start reading this awesome book. And she read me the first, like, two chapters, mm-hmm. and it was before Edward really shows up. And I was like, oh, hey, it's about this girl, and she's going to move to Forks, Washington, wherever the heck that is, which I think is really funny now that I'm living in Washington.
Right.
And you know, she's going to find, like, this guy or like, you know, she's going to have this relationship with her dad, and she's going to kind of learn to not be such a city girl or whatever and see what, like, you know, discover this whole connection to sparkly vampires.
What?
So
it turned into sparkly vampires?
So it turned into sparkly vampires when I was kind of expecting contemporary young adult coming of age.
Yeah.
But the fandom has done some interesting things. Like, a lot of them have basically taken the Twilight characters and written a lot of what's known as, like, alternate universe fan fiction, where they're mostly, you know, Bella and Edward are human and Bella and Edward are college professors or whatever, you know. So a lot of these stories have been published. Like, the most famous one, of course, is 50 Shades of Grey, where Bella is a young, naive college student, and Edward is, like, the successful CEO of a billion-dollar company, and there's
human
BDSM.
For incidentally.
Yes.
Yeah.
But 50 Shades of Grey is not my thing either. But I was thinking about it as I'd read those stories, and I thought about how, you know, if I really like what fan writers have done with, like, say, Harry Potter, like, why wouldn't there be really awesome Twilight stuff out there? And maybe I shouldn't necessarily dismiss the whole thing about people pulling their books for publication and turning them into original stories. Like, for example, I bought a book called Transcendence by an author named Shay Savage, and the description is that the hero is a caveman who doesn't speak, and the heroine is basically, she travels back in time somehow because science, I don't know, and like ends up stuck with him, and so it's, you know, like a caveman, like. And I found out that, like, that was also pulled to publish fan fiction. And I was like, that's kind of cool. Edward is a caveman? That's, like, I mean, he is kind of a creepy stalker, so why not? And another really famous one was Sylvain Renard's Gabriel's Inferno trilogy, which has the Edward character being a college professor that studies Dante. And the Bella character becomes kind of his Beatrice, or, you know, his muse. And I actually did start to read that one, and it's kind of awful, but it's sort of like sort of circled around back to being awesome.
Yeah.
Like it's so bad it's good. So it's just interesting. I think it's like, I don't know what I think. Like at first I had thought it was like, well, you know, pick your own damn stories. But I'm not entirely sure that I think that they're all necessarily derivative. And then the other thing that kind of brought this up for me was that a book I finished, I'd read it before, but then I reread it this morning or yesterday because I found it on Audible. It's called Bear, Otter, and the Kid, and the author is T.J. Klune, and it's an MM romance, and apparently according to one of the reviews on Goodreads, it has an eerie similarity to the gay movie Shelter, Sheltered, I can't remember which, and I've never seen that movie, and I'm not really sure that I have any desire to watch it but I did really like the book. And when I found out that it was basically like the same plot as another thing, it was kind of like, it broke my heart a little bit because I was like, well, you know, how could he steal this? But then, you know, as I've been thinking about this more and I ended up rereading the book and discovering that I still did really like it, like, does it matter? And so,
well,
I don't know.
It's
going
to be an individual taste question. I mean, it's going to be individual. I mean, it's kind of like, does it matter to you? If it doesn't matter to you, then it doesn't matter to other people. Then it may matter to other people. It just, you have to kind of take each one as it comes. I think in general, I have trouble with this concept when the people are taking the characters from books or movies or whatever and just transplanting them into their own universes without changing them. There is a series by I can't think of her name. It's like Sherlock Holmes and Mary Russell are married.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And all this stuff. And there have been new books added to it on Bard lately. And I have trouble with this, and I keep thinking, oh, I'm going to try that. It sounds kind of interesting, you know, but the thing I have trouble about is that the characters are the same as, you know, the Sherlock Holmes characters. Like, she doesn't really change the fundamentals about the character and basically continues in the Sherlock Holmes universe just after Sherlock Holmes stops, you know, the Arthur Conan Doyle stuff stops. I think the more changes that are made to the universe and to the characters, the more interesting and, I guess, potable I find the... potable? Did I just really say that? Oh, Lord. The more interesting and easier to get into, I find the stories. For example, the 50 Shades of Grey, which really isn't my thing either, and I haven't read it, but if no one had told me it was about Twilight, I wouldn't have known. I mean, they take the characters, they make them human. They also put them completely in a different setting. And I would have had no idea. With CBS's Elementary series, which I have watched, I actually think it's hysterical. Sherlock Holmes is completely, you know, in the modern age. The concept is funny. He is a drug addict in rehab. And if you read the Sherlock Holmes stories, he's actually a cocaine addict. And back then, that was just sort of the thing. You know, no one thought anything about it. People used cocaine all the time. And so now it's heroin, and he's, you know, been out of rehab, and Watson was his rehab counselor or, you know, like, sponsor. But it basically, I didn't know if I was going to like it because it's still Sherlock Holmes, and you know, he still has the same fundamental personality. But they put him into a different universe with different characteristics, and so I'm able to watch it. And some of the same characters come up, like there's a Moriarty. There's an Irene, what is her last name in the stories? Alderman?
Adler.
Alderman. I knew that was sort of close, but not right. There's an Irene Adler that comes up in the series, but it's a completely different person and they have different characteristics, but they have the same name. So if you know something about the stories, you're going to go, oh, but yet they're different. Moriarty, for instance, is a woman, which really like threw me off. I was like, whoa.
Oh, that's kind of awesome.
Yeah, it's really clever. So I think for me, if you have the same character with the same name, if you're an author basing your books on characters that have appeared before. If you take the character and remake him, give him new people to associate with, or put people that he associates with in the other author's stuff in different contexts, then it's fine. But if you just take him and transplant him, I have a problem with that. I'm kind of bored. I mean, you know. So I think that's where I stand on it, at the risk of, you know, not having read that much material, but having enough experience to know that I think that's where I draw the that's where I draw the line.
Well, and it'll be interesting to see, like, what, because I decided to, I got a couple of the books. I got the Caveman one, and I got the Gabriel's Inferno ones, and there's another
the,
one.
The Caveman one sounds pretty cool.
The Caveman one does sound really cool. I'm really looking forward to it.
I kind of
want
to read that.
Caveman. You know, what it'll be interesting to see, like, the Gabriel's Inferno one is all in third person. So for me, that makes it a little bit less Twilight-y, because, like, that was all first person.
Right.
And it's written by a man. So there's like, and like I said, there are real problems with it. but they're different problems than I think I had with Twilight.
Right.
And the MM book, the Bear, Otter, and the Kid, which, I really find that I don't care, because, like I said, I've not seen,
the movie that
he supposedly cribbed this from. Mm-hmm. And also, there are two sequels, and I feel like if there are two sequels, then, like, there probably weren't two sequels to the movie, so eventually he's if he did plagiarize from this movie, he went on to do other things,
right?
And he made it his own universe, and so I think that makes it okay for me.
Okay, well, I guess we'll transition not very elegantly into what I read this month. And I started a series by a new author that I had never tried before, Katie Hampstead, and the series is about a Jewish woman in, like, Egypt, way back, you know, when the Jews were the slave race. And Naomi, this woman, becomes the wife of Tutankhamun. No, his father, Akhenaten. And she is Tutankhamun's mother. And they have, you know, some of this is actually documented, but of course this is fictional. And this is just, you know, like, she gets, she marries the pharaoh and has to take an Egyptian name, and becomes Queen Kia. And then basically the first book is called Hope of the Pharaoh. And it takes her, you know, into, through all this process, you know, marrying the pharaoh and having children by him, and what the life was like in the pharaoh's palace, since she was forced to go and live there. And I kind of started the second book, but I had to put it aside because, you know, I have other things that I'm doing and working on, and I just haven't had time to finish it yet. But I really enjoyed the series, and I love historical fiction. So I enjoyed learning about, you know, what life might have been like for people living in that time and place. Of course, a lot of it is conjecture. There's some documented, you know, records, but not much. So I found it very interesting and fun. I mean, there's a little bit of romance, a little bit of sexual, you know, activity, but, you know, not a whole lot of coitus or anything like that that would be really offensive to those people who are offended by that sort of thing. Then let's see, what else did I read? Oh, something I read, because I have a friend who's really into Victorian literature, loves it. I can't stand it, and this book just brought it home for me. with a few exceptions. Northanger Abbey by Jane Austen. And we had the news story last month about the Jane Austen fan festival when they all dressed up in the costumes and everything. And it got me wanting to read another one of her books to see if I really enjoyed it. And I found a lot of the characters to be too cardboard for my taste. They were either, what was it? I tweeted this statement. They were either real jerks or real sappy. And I find that with a lot of books in that era, a lot of the characters have that same, it's not just her books, you know, whichever author of
no subtlety.
They're not subtle at all. There's no subtlety. There's no, well, he's kind of a jerk, but he has this likable quality that makes me get sort of attached to him. There was one character that he kept, I guess, pushing himself onto our main heroine, you know, like, I want to keep going out with you, and why aren't you going out with me, type of, to put it in modern parlance. And I'm kind of like, dude, can't you at least be a little likable? So whenever you come up in the book, I don't just go, oh, it's him again. I wasn't too thrilled, and actually it put me to sleep. So I fell asleep at about the fourth hour mark, you know, and I did finish it, but it took me several small, you know, reads to finish it. The third book that I read was called Lost Haven, and it's by our very good friend, or rather, you know, our good Twitter friend, Josh DeLioncourt, who is Lioncourt or Maxcessibility on Twitter. And it's his first book, so I purchased it. I think it's only available through Kindle. It may be on Bookshare, but I don't know because I don't have a Bookshare account.
No, I got it through, he self-published it, and I got it through Smashwords. Mm-hmm. Because if I can get it in EPUB, that's what I prefer to do, so I can put it more easily in Braille.
True.
Which I did, but I haven't read it yet.
Yeah, I read it during the readathon, and I read two books during the October readathon, and that was one of them. And both of the books I read were self-published Kindle books, and I read them on my Kindle app. But it's about a girl, Emily, who's a hockey player on her high school's hockey team, and she gets transported after a very tragic and horrific event into this other world, and this kind of like alternate sort of fantasy universe. And there are some parallels with our world. It's not really an alternate universe. It's kind of connected to our world in a certain way that you have to read the book to figure it out. And what happens to her after she's transported over there? And she ends up realizing that the regime that rules this world is very corrupt. And so she gets involved with sort of like this underground movement to overthrow it. And this is apparently the first part of a series. He's working on the second book as we speak. Hopefully it will be just as good as the first one. I really liked it a lot. And especially a lot of the sort of like violent scenes were very well described. And so if that's not your thing, you may want to be aware that there are some scenes with a lot of sort of like blood and gore in them. But I found that the heroine was pretty well written. And for a self-published book, I may have seen one typographical error in it, but for, you know, self-published, I spent my other self-published book that I read, I spent the whole time wondering if the husband's name was Howard or Harold, because it kept changing. Typos, unfortunately, although I can't stand them and I think they're terrible, getting more and more used to them in self-published material, which is very unfortunate.
Yes.
My last book was actually a reread, and what inspired me, other than my husband's suggestion to do our next book orders topic, which we'll talk about in a little while, for the book for next month. But this final book, I reread it usually at Halloween time, around about Halloween. One of my favorite books of all time, Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier, and it's kind of like a gothic novel, for lack of a better word. And it takes place in the late, I guess, 1930s or early 40s in this sort of spooky old house. This woman is a very sort of young, just out of school person, and she marries this much older man. And it was kind of like a fast wedding, and she didn't know all that much about him when she married him, other than his wife had died about 10 months ago, and he was kind of despondent. And I don't know, they fell in love and they got married. And then when she goes to his spooky old house, all sorts of spooky things start to happen to her. And there's nothing supernatural in any way about the book. But this housekeeper who takes care of the place is a crazy old bat and basically makes her life a crazy, scary hell. And if I don't mention her name, it's because it's rarely revealed in the book. I think it's revealed like one time as you go through the book, and it's towards the end. But the main person that the book revolves around is actually the dead wife, Rebecca. And the housekeeper basically adored her, and the house is basically set in the past. In other words, everything is the same way as when the previous Mrs. De Winter was alive. And no one wants to change anything. And then you find out towards the end of the book what really happened to Rebecca. Everyone thinks she drowned in a sailing accident. But as the book progresses, you find out that, there was more to it. And I read this in high school. I had to read it for a class. And I got it on record, I'll never forget, from NLS. And I was so impressed with the narrator, Barbara Caruso. And she is actually one of the few American readers that does a decent British accent. And I was so impressed with her, and she just made the book. I've read it in audio by a couple of other people, and it was not as good. So she really made the book for me, and so I was very glad last year when I found it on Bard. Her narration, of course, remastered for digital, and it was just as wonderful. The third reread this time, or I don't know, maybe it's fifth by now, as it was the first time I read it.
Yay!
Yay! So those were my books that I wanted to mention really quickly before we go into the news. And speaking of scary people, J.K. Rowling's Pottermore site is going to publish a Dolores Umbridge story on Halloween. And if none of you know who Dolores Umbridge is, she is the, well, she starts out the book as the Undersecretary of Magic. She starts out in the Harry Potter books, or Junior Undersecretary, something like that. And then sort of moves up as the books go on. She is one of the most sinister characters in the book, book series, and turns out to be quite spooky and gets even stranger
yes.
as the books go on. A new story about her early life and career to be published on Pottermore on Halloween. And what exactly is Pottermore? Do you know what it is? I've never been to the site.
I know that it's like the official sort of Harry Potter website that J.K. Rowling set up. I know that you can like log in and join it, but I don't really know what you get when that happens. And
right.
I know that she's written or has like teased about other things involving, you know, characters from the Harry Potter world on that website.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't really looked at it, to be honest. It like the books are enough for me, and I don't really want to mess with the like whatever it is that she's doing there.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same way. I've not been. I think the story is going to feature, like I said, stuff about Umbridge's early life and also Rowling's reflections on the character herself. So if you are all interested in that, go to Pottermore.com on Halloween and find it there. The Nielsen Children's Book Summit. Whether Harry Potter is actually a children's book is debatable, but these books featured at this summit certainly are. It's going to take place in New York City on December 12th. And this summit is, of course, all about books for kids. And they're going to do something interesting as well, which is to broaden it a little bit and not just consider books for kids, but also gaming and other multimedia platforms on which you could find children's material. So not just the printed word, but pretty much every, you know, everywhere else that you could find stuff for children, video games and maybe even apps. I'm not really sure about that. But definitely books and gaming. So I'm not sure who all is invited, because you got to be invited to this thing. But they promise that you will come away with all sorts of interesting ideas and be exposed to all sorts of fascinating content. I think that was actually a quote from the site.
Direct quote, yeah.
But you have to register, and it's on December 12th. It's probably
I'm sure it's a little bit out of our budget.
Yeah, I'm sure. And I'm sure that we would not be allowed to attend. It's probably more for like authors and publishers and other such ers that have a lot more clout than we do. However, speaking of books and, you know, literary creation, there are some people that believe that there is a new literary movement that has just started in the 21st century, well, late 20th, early 21st, called transrealism. This is where my computer crashed. So I sort of read it, but sort of didn't.
I sort of read it, too.
And I was kind of like, huh?
They're just making stuff up.
Yeah, this is what I think. Some critic named Rudolf Rucker has come up with the idea of transrealism, and I think I sort of understand what this is about. Authors are taking experiences from their own reality and transporting them into their books, and they are also putting in a horror or sci-fi component to take the experience out of reality and make it into something other than, I guess. And
yeah, they pinpoint, that's what I understood it to be too, but it kind of struck me as really pretentious.
I agree.
I feel like I said that already.
Yeah.
But it's like, well, you know, like I don't know that Philip K. Dick was necessarily the first author to do this. And it kind of seems to me like what the authors are saying is that if the book was like had commercial appeal, such as Harry Potter, then it doesn't count as transrealistic.
They're not. The experiences are not rooted enough in reality,
right.
Apparently. Oh, my God. But apparently, such people as Philip K. Dick and Stephen King and others fall into that category. But folks like The Hunger Games, books like The Hunger Games and Harry Potter do not. The experiences aren't rooted in reality to the same extent. I don't know. This was just such snobbery.
It really was.
Snubbery.
And I know, like, so Stephen King, I could see that with some of his books, like maybe Dolores Claiborne,
mm-hmm.
but certainly not all.
No,
I mean,
not all.
For you know, for example, It is like this great big sprawling book, but they're also like killer clowns that live in the sewers. So, no.
Huh?
Like,
yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, I don't know. That was very pretentious, but it was sort of interesting in a sort of not really kind of way, and it was kind of literary. Oh, Margaret Atwood and The Handmaid's Tale was another one that they talked about, which to me, I was so bored by that book. I don't know.
Like, if it has commercial appeal and it's interesting to actual people that aren't book critics, I feel like it doesn't count.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Okay, so there is a publisher that apparently is not doing too well. Just months in, Atavist Books says that it's closing its doors for the most part. It promised innovation ends its run. It started out focusing on ebook sales rather than printed book sales, and it was going to sell long books, I guess, books of longer length than just the shorter books, and focus on that and sell them in ebook form. And I guess they realized after this publisher had been out, you know, for just a couple of months, that people didn't want to read ebooks in a longer format. They wanted to read print books in that kind of format. And so, it didn't work out. Oh, well. And I can kind of see that. I mean, I wouldn't want to strain my eyes over a long book on my Kindle app or on my whatever device I had. I think I would much rather read it in print where it was easier to read. I'm not a sighted person, so I can't really say, but I can kind of see why that didn't take off.
I can see it too, but also I just feel like it's like, I don't know, as somebody who's been an avid romance reader for a long time, mostly because of ebooks, I probably would have read like a few romances, but I would not read as many as I had if it hadn't been for like various e-publishers that specialized in romance. And admittedly, a lot of what they publish are short novellas, but I can find, without really working that hard, many books of substantially lengthy, you know, romances that are, you know, way longer than ones that are would be traditionally published.
Yeah.
For example, I've got one now that I just bought yesterday that was like it's an 18-hour book, and it's mm-hmm. an MM romance, and that is not it was published by what was originally an e-publisher. They're doing more audio stuff now, but you know, I can't imagine that file was short.
Yeah, so, I can't imagine.
I'm sad that they closed offices, but I also feel like, nah, they're not really nearly as innovative as they thought they were. They just probably weren't publishing romance.
Yeah, well, I think they weren't publishing print books. I think that's the thing. They were just doing ebooks. And so focusing on ebooks was their innovative technique, I guess. I don't know. Anyway.
And the romance e-publishers that I know of do have print runs. Like, you can get the ebooks for the first, like, six or eight. I mean, you can always get the ebooks, but they're only available as ebooks for like maybe the first 6 months to a year. And then, like, if the books do well, then they do a print run.
Yeah. Well, last news story, Amazon reported losses this quarter and is projecting losses for next quarter. And we just have to put it in there because it's Amazon. There was really no other reason for including that story other than, oh, Amazon's not doing nearly as well as they used to. It's such a big conglomerate business, though, that there's no, you know, they're not going out of business.
I
don't think we need
this.
To worry too much. I do think that they launched that Fire Phone thing, and it's not doing nearly as well as they thought. They have like $80 million worth of Fire Phone inventory that's just sort of sitting there. So
I don't want one, that's for sure.
Yeah, I don't want one. I don't know anyone who does. Amazon, I think that was a flub. But they're going to continue to roll out new initiatives like the, what did they call them? Fulfillment centers, where you can go and pick up your stuff. They're
now
also
that would be awesome.
Yeah, that would be kind of cool. They're also going to try and roll out some Sunday delivery for the holidays. I don't know how that's going to work. But apparently, it's just what it says. You'll be able to get your deliveries over the holidays on Sundays.
Well, I hope so, because the last time I bought anything from Amazon, I got laundry detergent, which was like something that you kind of need right away when you make that purchase. Mm-hmm. And it was supposedly delivered, and I've never had a package from Amazon that just never showed up, but it was gone.
Oh, what'd you have to do?
I had to call them, and they did refund me my money, but I had to go to Target.
Yeah.
Like, I shop at Amazon, so I don't have to leave my house. But
right,
no.
Exactly.
And then it didn't even save me any money.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, what a bummer.
That's my random Amazon story that has nothing to do with anything.
But,
sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. It happens. I've never had a delivery not show up, just knock on wood, because I just ordered something from them yesterday. Well, rather, two things. They're both supposed to arrive on Tuesday. Let's hope that they arrive when they say they will. But that is my random Amazon musing, because now that you mention it, now it's making me think, what if it doesn't show up?
Well, apparently the carrier that they used for this particular package is not what is only the one they have available on the West Coast. So you might be good because you don't have OnTrack.
That's true. And there are like all kinds of deliveries made in my neighborhood every day. Actually, it's not that I'm worried that the carrier's not going to show up, but every time we have deliveries in our neighborhood, it seems like a lot of times I see on our neighborhood website that they get delivered to the wrong house.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so they're delivered to the wrong house, and we see things like, missing package, who ordered X and X from X? It's at our house, come and pick it up. You know, and I'm like, oh, crap, I hope it's not going to be us. Hope it's not going to be my next package. Because they're just, the houses are like really close together.
Right.
And the trucks go up and down the street all day. I mean, you know, UPS and FedEx are here all the time. But the houses are close together and they get them mixed up sometimes. Anyway, randomness aside, we will talk about Nosferatu by Joe Hill, Stephen King's son, that we read this month for our horror pick.
Yes, we did. I liked it. I thought that it was fun. I didn't think, I don't know, it was not trans-realist.
No.
It's really not.
No, I agree. It was fun and somewhat creepy. I'm not keen on the narrator. Her voice to me is like sandpaper. I just, there's something about it I just do not like. But, all that aside, I would rather have had it read by her than by Martha Harmon Pardee on Bard. And those were the choices I had. What is her name? Kate something.
Kate Mulgrew. She played Captain Janeway on Star Trek Voyager.
Yes, she and indeed she did. And
I actually have to say that, like, you know, ooh, dramatic moment. I totally disagreed. I loved her narration.
Oh!
Because my theory is that if you are a Star Trek captain, like, one of the things they teach you in Starfleet Academy is to choose scenery, and you don't get to rise up in the ranks of like, Starfleet until you can prove that you can be like, I am not going to take this anymore. You will give me back my ship. Or whatever. But I really, I thought that like, for the purposes of this book, she chewed a lot of scenery. And it made it even more fun for me.
I thought she did a good job as far as narrating the book. I thought she did fantastic. I'm just not real keen on her, although I thought that she made, like, Charlie Manx's voice. It was like, it was perfect. It was like, grrr.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, yeah. Like, so creepy. And I thought she did a good job with all the voices, really. I'm just not keen on her voice, but if I can get, you know, if I put that aside, then I definitely thought it was a great choice of narration and a very great book. It was not one of those books, like, it did not have, for me, it was not something that I could just, I mean, with some of Stephen King's books, I just can't put them down. It's like, they're so wonderful, and I get so wrapped up in them that I just couldn't put them down. This did not have that for me. I was able to read it for 20, 30 minutes at a time, and then that was it. I could put it down and go do other stuff and didn't feel like I was missing out because I wasn't reading it. But I did enjoy it, and I really feel that the whole, like, Christmas land thing is really screwing with my brain, and I am not keen on Christmas this year. I just, the whole concept is freaking me out.
Thanks, Joe Hill.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I really liked it. I thought that he wrote the female, he wrote the female character, you know, Victoria, really, really well.
He did, and I've always thought that was one thing that Stephen King himself was not particularly good at. Like, his women are, you know, at their best, they're kind of like, eh, they're there. And like, well, except for Dolores Claiborne, that's still one of my favorite books. But, you know, for the most part, I think that his women are considerably weaker characters than his men. But I really liked that in this book, like, whoever taught Joe Hill to write female characters did a phenomenal job, because there are more than one of them, and they all do stuff.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there are some Stephen King female characters that I think are good, like Beverly in It is a pretty well-drawn kid.
Yeah.
We've got Susanna in the Dark Tower series that's fairly well done, and in Insomnia, we have, you know, Lois, who's a little less well done, but still, you know, she does stuff too. But then he does have, you know, and of course, Annie in Misery, without a doubt, is.
Oh, yeah.
You know. So, but then, you know, some of his other work, they're kind of like just sort of either they're there as support to their husbands, who are the main heroes of the stories, or, you know, they're kind of just there, as in Needful Things. Polly is,
oh yeah.
There wasn't really anything about her that stood out, which was a shame, because she was kind of like a kind of interesting person, but very much less well developed than you know, the sheriff in the book, for instance, whose name escapes me, but anyway. So I thought that you know, in this book, Maggie also was really well done.
Yeah.
As a character.
And he does a lot of, and I liked that he has a pretty diverse cast of characters. Like, you know, it's he does, there was like one of the police officers was Indian, and I think there was a black guy in there at some point, and then there was, like, you know, Maggie who was a lesbian, and like it was, you know, putting all these different sort of diverse perspectives in there without it necessarily feeling like, oh, you know, let's tick off this box. It was just sort of like, well, you know, this is sort of a cross section of the way the world is, and so I really liked that he did that.
Yeah, I enjoyed that too. And I especially liked, I mean, the whole thing of Christmasland being this exciting place for kids, but at the same time, yet so creepy. And I liked the car. Which basically, as you wrote in it, took away your empathy, especially if you were a child. And the whole notion of Charlie Manx being a vampire, but sort of like one that feeds off of someone's mental energy, is a really interesting concept to explore, especially since most vampires that we know of, you know, are like blood-sucking fiends or blood-sucking good guys, you know, who really don't take much of your blood, just enough to keep them alive, you know.
And they sparkle.
And they sparkle, absolutely. And so I really did like that concept, and I was interested to see how he dealt with it and how he sort of like wove the car into it. I would have loved more sort of like backstory on Charlie Manx, like how he got the car. That was one question that he really didn't answer. It was kind of like, well, how did this car even get to be part of his you know, modus operandi? You know, how did he even start using the car, and where did it come from? And what did he use before he had the car? Because apparently he was like really, really, really super old, you know, possibly older than the car. And so what did he use before he had the car? Were questions that, you know, I wanted to answer, but it's okay if he didn't, because it was mostly about Victoria and her getting her kid back. But, you know, I enjoyed it, and I hope that he comes out with some things that are, you know, equally as good. I haven't read any of Joe Hill's other stuff, so I can't say. But my takeaway from this book is he writes good horror, and his writing style is definitely different from his dad's, which is a good thing. He's not just a carbon copy.
And I did have to say that I loved Lewis Carmody. I think he was maybe one of my favorite.
He was my favorite. I loved him. I loved Lou. He was so awesome. I just, oh my goodness. He was so sweet. He had such a sweetness to him. And it was like, you know, like this big teddy bear. And he loved Victoria just for being herself. And it was like, oh, you think there's this crazy world out there? Okay, well, okay. I'll ride with that. What do you need me to do to help you? And I love you, and I'll do anything for you. It was just, it was the sweetest thing. And I loved him. I just thought he made the book for me.
Yeah, and the whole, like, the whole family dynamic between the three of them, Lou and Victoria and Wayne, like, it was just, it was so great.
It was. Absolutely. And emphasizing, you know, your family doesn't have to be perfect, but as long as you love one another, that's really what counts. It's not, you don't have to have the perfect carbon copy as seen on TV family, but, you know, if you love one another, then that's the main thing. That was wonderful. Moving right along, unless you have anything else to say.
Yeah, speaking of families.
On for a while. Speaking of families.
Yeah, speaking of families, let's talk about our next book.
It has nothing to do with families. Well, it sort of does. Our next book, our topic is books we read in school or that are typically assigned in school. And we'd like to hear a lot about the books that you read in school. Please send us some listener mail, because we didn't get any this time. Moo-hoo!
We're sad.
We're sad. But if you read books you'd like to tell us about and your experiences with them, we'd love to hear about it. But as a token book for this topic, we're going to pick, I picked a book that I have read in school and that Shannon never did read.
No.
I picked Silas Marner by George Eliot. And her real name was like Marianne something or other. But, you know, it was written in the 1800s. So no female authors were kind of frowned upon. And she chose to go by a man's name. Silas Marner by George Eliot. And it's about a man who lives in a village and, you know, up on this mountain, I think. And he comes there as a weaver, and they hire him to do their weaving for them. You know, the villagers bring their weaving to him. And he's really a loner. He has some reasons for wanting to be alone. And then, well, there's a kind of family dynamic that comes into play in this book as well. And I won't spoil it. You'll just have to find out what causes him to be, you know, he has to integrate with the villagers and how that all works out. I will warn you that there are a lot of philosophical rants in the book. The author goes on these moral diatribes occasionally. They usually occur at the end of each chapter, so if you start hearing them, just hit your next button. I mean, you know, and occasionally they can be quite lengthy. So, you know, if you start hearing them, you can hit your next button. You probably won't miss much. Now, of course, this is what I remember from reading the book over 20 years ago. So maybe there is something that you would miss. I'm not really sure. You know, but this is my memory of having read it in senior English class or something. You know, I was able to skip the moral diatribes by pressing the fast forward button and listening to the little pause that indicates silence. Once I found that little silence pause, I started it back at the next chapter and was good to go.
You were good to go.
So
I, it is interesting because when I mentioned on Twitter that I was excited to read this book, like my mentions were suddenly filled with people being like, ugh, Silas Marner, gross.
So. Yeah, and Rodney was not too keen on the book either. I told him about it. He was like, oh my God, you're reading Silas. I actually like the book because I identified with him. And in order, I won't talk about why, but... well, I will next time, because by then you will have read the book. But there is a reason
yes.
that I identify with Silas Marner and his struggles, I guess, and the things that set him apart from other people. So anyway, that was one of the reasons that I actually liked it and was able to stick with it when a lot of my classmates were like, what the heck are we reading? Ew, this is disgusting. And I'm like, yeah, but... So, I mean, I think it's a very well-written book. It's probably a little, it's not that long. There is a lot of moral preaching that goes on, so just beware of that. But we will talk about this on our next podcast, number 27 or 8.
I think that's right, 27 or 8.
I don't even know what number this is. That's really sad. I think this is 27, and the next one will be 28. But... all that aside, if you want to contact me via Twitter, contact us via Twitter, you can find the podcast at Book Hoarders on Twitter or bhapodcast@gmail.com or on the website at bhapodcast.com.
And if you want to talk to us individually, you can contact me. I'm at Bardsong, and Aaron is at Aaron Edgar. And if you want to listen to, or if
nope.
you want, oh, I guess you're not
it's
doing
it. Not.
Show
I'm
anymore.
No melting pot.
No melting pot.
Melting pot is on hiatus for the next several months. But if you
it's
want
gone.
To visit Shannon's blog,
which I posted a couple of woo-hoo! Things in the past few weeks.
Yes, indeed. it is, there I go with indeed again. It is flightintofantasy.com.
Yes.
And so we look forward to seeing you next time. And, you know, at this point, we'll just simply say, happy reading.
Bye.
Bye.
To contact the Book Hoarders, send email to bhapodcast@gmail.com. Follow Book Hoarders on Twitter. Call us at 520-81-BOOKS, 520-812-6657. And visit the website at bhapodcast.com.